think, therefore I am.
Right.
I mean, it's essentially the ultimate bumper sticker of Western philosophy. You hear that phrase and you immediately picture a guy sitting by a fireplace.
Wearing a heavy robe.
Exactly. Yeah. Just sitting there doubting his own existence until he realizes that the very act of doubting proves he exists. It's purely intellectual. It's totally abstract.
It creates a very specific image, doesn't it?
It really does. Like a brain in a jar.
Yeah, the solitary genius, sort of detached from the messy physical world, living entirely inside his own head.
And here's where it gets really interesting and, frankly, kind of weird. We have a stack of research here today based on a lecture by Dr. Arthur Holm.
A fantastic lecture, by the
way. Absolutely. And it turns out that while everyone knows Descartes was obsessed with the mind, he was actually equally obsessed with the meat.
The meat?
Yeah. The actual biological machinery of the human body.
That is definitely the side of Descartes that usually gets skipped in, you know, intro to philosophy. We focus on the cogito, but we tend to forget that he was also writing extensively about physiology.
And when we say physiology, we aren't talking about cells and DNA. We are talking about hydraulics.
Yeah.
I mean, very few people realize this, but the father of modern philosophy viewed the human body as a literal hydraulic machine run by fluids and tubes and gas pressure.
It sounds totally bizarre to modern ears, but he meant it quite literally. He viewed the body as an automaton.
So the mission for our deep dive today is to look past the abstract brain in a jar stuff. We are going to explore what is essentially Descartes' practical guide to happiness.
A survival guide, almost.
Exactly. We're going to see how he believed we could hack this hydraulic machine to control our emotions. And then, because we love a good debate, we're going to introduce a challenger.
Blaise Pascal.
Right. His contemporary, who basically thought Descartes was trying to solve a spiritual problem with a calculator.
It's really a showdown between the pilot and the gambler. Two very different ways of navigating the chaos of life.
I love that framing. The pilot and the gambler. So let's start with the hardware. If we want to understand Descartes' advice on how to live, Dr. Holmes says we have to understand his view of the body first.
Right. And his view is, well, it's distinctively mechanical. To understand where he's coming from, you really have to remember that Descartes is a dualist.
Capital D dualist.
Exactly. He divides the entire universe into two completely separate substances. On one side, you have mind or the soul, which is the thinking thing.
The invisible stuff.
Yeah. And on the other side, you have matter, which is everything physical, and that includes your body.
This is the classic ghost in the machine concept, right?
Precisely. But here's the nuance that a lot of people miss. In the medieval view, or even going all the way back to the Greeks, the soul was the spark of life.
Like a battery.
Right. It was the thing that made the body move, made it digest food and grow. If the soul left, all the biological processes just stopped. But Descartes says, no.
He totally flips that script.
He does. He argues that the body is a self-operating mechanism.
Like a clock.
A clock is a great analogy. Or think of those really intricate animatronic figures they had in the royal gardens of Europe around that time.
Oh, the water features.
Yeah. You step on a hidden plate on the path, and water pressure shoots through a pipe, and it makes a statue of Neptune move its arm or something.
Right.
Descartes thought the human body worked exactly like that. It doesn't need a soul to pump blood or digest a sandwich. It just needs the mechanism to be intact.
So, theoretically, if I drop dead and my soul leaves the building, but you kept the pumps running and the fluids moving, the body would just keep ticking over like a zombie car engine.
In his view, yes. The body is functionally independent. It's just a machine made of meat.
And the fuel for this machine is this concept of animal spirits. Now, I have to clarify for everyone listening, when we say spirits, we aren't talking about ghosts or poltergeists.
No, not at all. In 17th century physiology, animal spirits were physical matter.
Right. Tangible stuff.
Exactly. Descartes described them as very subtle, very active fluids, almost like a gas or a really fine wind that were distilled from the blood in the brain.
So if you picture hydraulic fluid in a heavy construction machine.
That is the perfect analogy. He believed our nerves were literally hollow tubes. These animal spirits would flow through the tubes to inflate the muscles. And when the muscles inflate, the limb moves.
It's wildly incorrect from a modern medical standpoint. Obviously, we know it's electrochemical, but as an engineering concept, it's actually kind of brilliant.
It is an elegant theory for its time.
The body is a system of pipes and pressure.
Yes, but this creates a massive problem for a dualist.
Because of the communication gap.
Exactly. If the soul is non-physical,
Yeah.
You know, it has no weight, no mass, no actual location. And the body is this physical hydraulic pump. How do they talk to each other?
Where is the joystick?
Right. Where do they interface?
And his answer was the pineal gland.
The pineal gland. A tiny structure right in the center of the brain.
I just love that he pinpointed this one specific little gland. Why the pineal gland? Why not the frontal lobe or the heart?
It came down to basic anatomy for him. Descartes looked at the brain and saw that almost everything is doubled. We have two hemispheres, two eyes, two ears.
Right, symmetry.
But our conscious experience feels singular. We don't see two worlds. We see one continuous world. The pineal gland is right in the center, and it looks singular. So he concluded that must be the seat of the soul.
The central command center.
Right. He imagined the soul essentially suspended inside this gland, sort of dangling over the passages where these animal spirits flow.
Okay, I'm picturing this.
When the soul wants to move the arm, it somehow, and this part is a bit fuzzy, it wiggles or tilts this gland.
Like a little rudder in a stream.
That's exactly it. The gland tilts, which redirects the flow of the animal spirits into the specific nerve tubes leading to the arm. The muscles inflate, and whoosh, the arm moves.
But, and this is the part that sets up his entire ethical system. It works both ways. The body can also move the gland.
Correct. And this is crucial. Say you burn your finger on a stove.
Okay.
The fire displaces the skin, which pulls a tiny thread inside the nerve tube, which opens a valve up in the brain, sending a massive rush of animal spirits to jiggle the pineal gland.
And the soul feels that jiggle.
Exactly. The soul perceives that physical jiggle as pain.
And this brings us to what he called the passions, because this is where the biology turns into psychology.
Yes. Dr. Holmes emphasizes a really important distinction that Descartes makes here between actions and passions.
Let's break this down.
So, actions are what the soul does voluntarily. Reasoning, imagining, making a deliberate choice. That's the pilot actively steering the ship.
And the passions.
The passions are what happened to the soul. That's why they're called passions. It shares the root word with passive.
Oh, that makes so much sense.
Right. Fear, anger, love, desire, sadness. These aren't things you do. These are things that the hydraulic machine inflicts upon you.
That is such a helpful reframe. So when I get a sudden surge of road rage or I'm terrified of public speaking, that's not me failing as a person. That's just the machine flooding the engine.
Essentially, yes.
Yeah.
The animal spirits are storming the cockpit. The physical body perceives a threat or a sudden desire, and it mechanically dumps these fluids to trigger a reaction.
And the soul is just sitting there in the pineal gland getting blasted.
Receiving this massive, overwhelming wave of sensation.
And you can't just delete the feeling, right? Because it's an actual physical thing. It's literal fluid coursing through your pipe.
Exactly. You cannot simply will the animal spirits to stop flowing any more than you can will your own blood to stop circulating.
Right.
This is the central conflict of Descartes' ethics. We are rational souls trapped inside a machine that is constantly bombarding us with intense, sometimes totally irrational, physical data.
So what's the move? Are we just slaves to the machine? If the fluids say, be afraid, do we just have to be afraid?
No, thankfully. Descartes argues that while we can't stop the initial physical impulse, we aren't completely helpless. We can hack the system.
How?
He calls it using right reason.
Okay, this is the hacking the passions part. How do we fight physical hydraulic pressure with just a thought?
We use the power of representation. Mm. The mind has this incredible ability to visualize consequences.
Walk me through an example of how that works in real life.
Sure. Let's say you have a passion, a strong desire to do something dangerous, or maybe just a desire to skip work and sleep in.
A very relatable passion.
Very. The body is screaming, comfort, rest. The animal spirits are rushing toward these stay-in-bed muscles.
Right.
Can't just say, stop. Willpower alone usually fails against physiology.
Oh, always.
But your mind can conjure up a vivid mental image of the consequences. You can visualize getting fired. You can visualize the poverty, the stress, the loss of reputation.
So I'm fighting a physical urge with a mental movie.
Exactly. But here's the genius trick. That mental movie triggers its own physical response. That negative visualization causes the pineal gland to tilt a different way, which sends a counterflow of animal spirits, maybe fear or aversion, that physically blocks the original flow.
You're literally rerouting the plumbing by changing the picture on the screen.
That is exactly. It is remarkably similar to modern cognitive behavioral therapy.
That's exactly what I was thinking.
Right. You change the narrative to change the physiological response. Descartes believed that with enough training, right reason gives us absolute power over the passions.
And the goal here isn't just to be a robot, right? He's not saying we should have zero emotions.
No, no. The goal is contentment. He was heavily influenced by the Stoics. He wanted to achieve that state where there is an absence of pain in the body and trouble in the mind.
Inner peace.
Yes. He wants us to be the masters of our own internal fortress, rather than just being tossed around by every random wave of animal spirits.
But Descartes also realized that mastering your internal fortress takes, like, a lifetime. And in the meantime, you still have to live in the real world. You have to pay rent, talk to your neighbors, and try not to get arrested.
Right. He didn't want to be paralyzed by analysis paralysis while he was trying to figure out the deep secrets of the universe.
Yeah.
He famously compared it to rebuilding your house. You need a temporary shed to live in while the main construction is happening.
So he developed what he called a provisional morality. Basically, Descartes' four rules for life.
Exactly. These were the practical maxims he followed to navigate the world while his grand philosophy was under construction.
Let's run through them because I think they are surprisingly practical for anyone listening, even if you don't buy into the whole hydraulic body stuff.
They hold up remarkably well.
Okay, maxim number one, conformity and moderation.
This is essentially the don't rock the boat rule.
Nah.
Obey the laws, follow the customs, and stick to the religion of your country. And most importantly, always choose the most moderate political and social opinions.
Which, I gotta say, sounds incredibly boring for a guy who literally revolutionized Western thought.
It does seem contradictory.
Was he just scared of the church? I mean, Galileo was getting a lot of heat around this exact time.
There was definitely some self-preservation there.
Yep.
He didn't want to be burned at the stake. But logically, he argues it's about error minimization.
How so?
Think about the math of it. If you take an extreme stance on anything, and you happen to be wrong, you are catastrophically wrong. You are miles away from the truth.
Oh, I see. But if you stay in the middle...
If you stick to the moderate middle, even if you're wrong, you aren't too far off. It's a strategy to minimize social friction. If you aren't fighting with everyone around you about politics or custom, you have way more mental energy left for your own work.
It's camouflage for the intellectual.
Exactly.
Okay, moving to maxim number two. And this is the one I think is most useful for anyone listening who struggles with anxiety. Resolution and firmness.
Yes, this addresses the agony of decision-making.
Mm-hmm.
Descartes says that once you decide on a course of action, you must follow it with absolute firmness, even if the original decision was a bit doubtful.
Dr. Holmes used a great analogy here, the traveler in the forest.
It's a classic Cartesian image. Imagine you are lost in a dense forest. You have no map. You have no compass. What do you do?
Well, most people panic. They walk a little way, get scared, turn back, try another path, or just sit down and wait.
Exactly. And that guarantees you die in the forest. Descartes says, pick a direction, any direction at all, and walk in a straight line. Don't deviate.
Because logically, if you just walk in a straight line, eventually you'll hit a road or a river or a clearing. You'll get somewhere.
Right. It might not be the perfect destination, but it is infinitely better than being stuck in the middle of the woods.
Yeah.
But the psychological point he's making is even deeper. It prevents vacillation.
Vacillation, that state where you just keep second-guessing yourself. Did I take the right job? Should I have moved to that other city? Did I marry the right person?
That constant regret, that remorse, it creates emotional turbulence. It churns up the animal spirits. Descartes says, make the choice, own the choice, and don't look back.
Wow.
Even if it turns out to be the wrong choice,
yeah.
The decisiveness itself brings peace of mind.
That is actually profound. It's not about being right. It's about being resolved.
Perfectly said.
All right. Maxim number three. Conquer self, not fortune.
This one is pure stoicism. He basically says there are things we control, which is our thoughts and our desires, and things we don't control, the world, the weather, the economy, other people.
And if you tie your happiness to things you can't control, you are just setting yourself up for misery.
Precisely. If you desire for it not to rain on your wedding day, you are gambling your happiness on the clouds. But if you change your desire, if you say to yourself, I will be content regardless of the weather, you guarantee your own happiness.
So don't try to bend the world to your will. Bend your will to the world.
Change the desire, not the fortune.
And finally, maxim number four, choose the best occupation.
And conveniently enough, he decided the best possible occupation was being a philosopher, cultivating reason.
Big surprise there.
Right.
Rule four, be exactly like me, René Descartes.
Well, you have to look at it from his perspective. If right reason is the ultimate tool that hacks the passions and brings you contentment, then a life dedicated to sharpening that tool must be the happiest life. It's consistent, at least.
Fair enough. It is consistent. So we have this very structured, logical, almost a defensive way of living. But, and we have to talk about this, there is a darker side to this mechanical worldview.
There is.
Dr. Holmes points out a critique in the lecture that feels very relevant to us today. Because when Descartes split the mind from the body, he didn't just split humans in half. He sort of split humans from nature.
Yes, this is the environmental critique. And it is quite significant. By defining the soul or mind as this totally separate non-physical substance that only humans have, Descartes and his contemporaries essentially evacuated the natural world of any spiritual value.
Nature just becomes stuff.
Exactly. If an animal doesn't have a rational soul, which Descartes firmly believed they didn't, then an animal is just a machine, a biological automaton.
So a dog crying out in pain.
In the strict Cartesian view, that is no different than a gear grinding in a clock. It's just mechanical noise. It's not suffering in the way we understand it.
Oof. That is a really grim thought.
It is very grim. But if nature is just a machine, then we have no moral obligation to it. We can exploit it, use it, break it, and fix it.
Right.
This philosophy, alongside Francis Bacon's work, really laid the intellectual groundwork for the Industrial Revolution. We became the masters and possessors of nature, to use Descartes' own phrase.
It effectively desacralized the whole world. And we also see the seeds of utilitarianism here too, don't we?
We do. Because notice how Descartes judges actions. He doesn't say, do this because it is inherently holy or good. He says, do this because it leads to contentment. He's always calculating the consequences.
Right. It's an algorithm for well-being.
And that heavy focus on calculation brings us perfectly to his challenger.
Enter Blaise Pascal.
The mathematician, the physicist, the prodigy, a younger contemporary of Descartes.
If Descartes is the guy trying to solve life with an algorithm and a wrench, Pascal is the guy saying, you're using the wrong equation entirely.
Exactly. Now, Pascal respected reason. He was a genius mathematician, after all. But he argued that reason has hard limits. He famously said, the heart has its reasons that the mind does not know.
Now, we need to be really careful here. When he says the heart, he's not talking about Hallmark card emotions, right? Yeah. He's not saying just follow your bliss.
No, and that is a very common misunderstanding. For Pascal, the heart refers to intuition. It is the ability to grasp first principles instantly without needing a logical proof.
Give me an example of knowing something with the heart.
Okay, think about space.
Yeah.
How do you know space has three dimensions? Can you write out a mathematical logical proof for that from scratch?
No, I see it. I exist in it.
Exactly. You intuit it. You know it immediately. Or how do you know you aren't dreaming right now? You can't prove it logically. Descartes actually tried and tied himself in absolute knots over it. But your heart, your intuition, knows it as a basic fact.
So Pascal is saying that the most important things in life, God, morality, existence, are data points that the logical machine simply cannot process.
Exactly. He thought Descartes was arrogant to think he could prove God or ethics like a geometry problem. Pascal argued that at a certain point, the machine fails, and you just have to rely on intuition.
But, and here is the twist that I really love. Pascal didn't abandon logic entirely. He actually used it to checkmate the skeptics.
Yes.
This is where we get the famous Pascal's wager.
The wager is brilliant because it meets the rationalist on their own turf. It's pure game theory.
He basically says, okay, let's assume we can't know for sure if God exists. The data is inconclusive. Logic is deadlocked. So we have to place a bet.
Right. You are forced to play. You're already alive, so you're already at the table. So what are the odds?
Let's run the numbers.
If you bet on God, meaning you live a religious life, you act as if he exists and you win. You gain infinity, eternal happiness.
And if you lose, say you die and there's nothing, just worms and dirt.
Then you've lost very little. Maybe you missed out on some Sunday mornings or some worldly pleasures, but the cost was finite.
But if you bet against God.
If you bet against God and you turn out to be wrong, you lose everything. Infinite loss.
So the prudent bet, the mathematically sound bet, is to believe, even if you aren't entirely sure.
It is calculation used to justify faith. And notice the similarity to Descartes here. Both of these men are absolutely obsessed with prudence.
That's so true. Descartes is using the forest analogy to minimize everyday regret. Pascal is using the wager to minimize the risk of eternal damnation.
They are both trying to navigate a world of deep, profound uncertainty. Descartes wants to be the pilot, steering a ship with ironclad reason and hacking his own biology.
Yeah.
Pascal is the gambler, calculating the odds, but ultimately acknowledging that you have to trust your intuition when the map runs out.
So bringing this back to you, our listener today, We know we aren't full of hydraulic fluid. We have neurotransmitters and cortisol and hormones, but the struggle feels exactly the same.
It really is the same. We are still ghosts in the machine. We have this biological hardware that freaks out, gets anxious, gets addicted, gets angry, and we have this voice in our head, the pilot trying to control it.
Descartes gives us the toolkit to hack the hardware, reframe the narrative, visualize the consequences, change the flow. I mean, he's basically the grandfather of self-help.
He really is. And Pascal reminds us that you can't think your way out of everything. Sometimes the spreadsheet doesn't have the answer. Sometimes you just have to trust your gut. You have to make the bet.
It's a balance. You need the pilot, but you also need the heart.
Precisely.
Before we wrap up today, I want to leave everyone with a final provocative thought, sort of building on that third maxim. Descartes said, conquer yourself, not fortune, basically. The world is what it is. Just accept it and find peace inside. That was really wise advice in the 1600s when you couldn't cure smallpox or stop a famine or communicate instantly across the globe.
True. They were largely at the mercy of nature back then. Stoicism was a necessary survival mechanism.
But today, we live in the house that Descartes and Bacon built. We actually can change fortune.
We can.
We can cure diseases. We can geoengineer the climate. We can rewrite DNA. We can literally move mountains.
It changes the moral calculus completely.
It really does. If we have the power to change the world, is Stoic acceptance still wisdom? Or is it now just a cop-out? If you can stop the rain, do you have a moral obligation to close your umbrella and actually fix the weather?
That is the ultimate modern dilemma. We have Cartesian power, the immense power of the machine, but we are still searching for the wisdom to know when to use it and when to just accept things as they are.
Something to chew on while you pilot your own hydraulic machine through the rest of the day. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive into the hydraulics of happiness.
It's a pleasure.
We'll see you on the next one.